Hello.
Well, good evening, everyone. Thank you for being here. Elizabeth, it's great to have you in Traverse City.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
We had a wonderful day today. We visited Front Street Writers, saw the work that those kids are doing on gun reporting. Visited creative writers at Interlochen. They surprised you a little bit.
Almost all of them. I asked 24 people. I said, how many of you listen to NPR? And I think probably 20 hands went up. So it was a good sign.
So we met in St. Paul.
Yes.
And I think it's fair to say that I was encouraged to invite you when you told me you're from Michigan. You grew up in Mount Pleasant.
Right.
You still come back to Grayling. It was when I heard Grayling. I said, well, you've got to come to Traverse City and meet all my friends.
Very short drive, right?
They all are.
Right.
So I think I heard today your first gig in journalism was an internship at the Mount Pleasant Morning Star. Did I?
Morning Sun.
Yep. Morning Sun.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yep.
And
yep.
But you told the kids that it was Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman that got you into journalism.
So
tell us about that.
Yes, it's true. There is an entire class of journalists who went into journalism because of the movie All the President's Men. I was one of them. I originally wanted to be a social worker, and I saw the movie and said, hey, you know what? Maybe I'll go into journalism. And so that was my senior year of high school, and I applied to Northwestern, got in, and ended up having a journalism career. So.
And you've pretty much written for every major newspaper in this country, as far as I can tell. LA Times, New York Times, Wall Street Journal.
Yep, I had a pretty traditional newspaper career that you really wouldn't have these days. I started in the trade press, electronic media. It was a publication that no longer exists, but that covered television and radio business. And then I worked my way up. I went to the New York Daily News, the Wall Street Journal, LA Times, and then 10 years writing for the New York Times. So
tell us, someone already asked me, what is an ombudsman?
Okay.
I said it's a public editor,
good,
which I don't think clarifies a lot.
Right.
Sketch out what an ombudsman does and
right,
what success is in your job.
Right. So I'm glad you asked about actually the nomenclature because it's a little tricky. So a lot of people know an ombudsman from, say, a hospital or a university. So it's more of a mediator function, right? It's an ombudsman is there to solve a problem. You have a problem with billing with the hospital, you go to the hospital ombudsman. A news ombudsman's a little bit different. Most publications have now switched to the title of public editor. I'm trying to get NPR to switch over too.
Why the resistance?
I'm sorry?
Why the resistance?
I'm not sure. I think just because it's always been the title of ombudsman, I think they believe that the audience knows that title, knows how to reach the ombudsman. Public editor describes a little bit better what the job is, which is I am the public's representative in the newsroom. So it's my job to connect the newsroom with public concerns. And then there's a function, of course, that comes back the other way, which is sort of explaining how the newsroom operates to the public. So that's where the transparency comes in. So explaining, you know, if NPR makes a change on air a couple years ago, pretty early in my tenure, they started introducing all the newscasts with the word live. Right, and so a lot of listeners didn't understand that, and so it was sort of I thought it was my role to sort of basically explain why that was. Where an ombudsman differs from sort of an outside critic is that I am paid by NPR, I report to the CEO, but my contract is written such that I have complete independence within the organization. I have no management role in the newsroom. They can't tell me what to do. I can't tell them what to do. I can tell them what to do. They can just ignore me, which they sometimes do. but they give me space on the NPR website for a column where I can basically publicly explore issues that I think that the public has raised certainly, and that I think the public needs to understand. I can take them to task. I can say, this is what I really think needs to be changed. I can praise them sometimes. You know, I think NPR is a great journalistic organization. They do a lot of things that are very good. But traditionally, the role is more sort of keeping the journalism on track. You know, I think in some ways we're all on the same side because we all want the journalism to be very strong. But my role is to be a little bit more of an adversary. You know, one of the other things is being inside the organization, you have a access that maybe an outside press critic doesn't. So NPR, we were talking about that this morning. NPR had an error last week. It was a big error. People were upset about it. The Washington Post called the media relations person at NPR and said, how did this happen? And she said, I'm not going to tell you. you know, that's sort of a traditional relationship. But I decided that it was important enough that on Monday, I went in because we had gotten a number of complaints from the public.
This is the Easter.
I don't know if you all were familiar with this, but NPR made a very bad mistake on Good Friday in how it described Easter. Completely mangling what exactly Easter is.
She's not exaggerating.
It was pretty bad. It was pretty bad. And so I kind of wanted to understand sort of how this happened, and then part of my role is to, as I see it, is to sort of say, okay, how can we not have this happen again? This was a bad error. What are the systemic problems? Sometimes people make mistakes. Good newsrooms have safeguards in place to keep those mistakes from happening on a regular basis. So part of what I wanted to figure out was whether there were safeguards that were missing from the process. And so what it was the reporter made a mistake. The editor was being a little bit flip and working too fast and didn't catch it. I think the element that I added is NPR does not have copy editors who look at the digital copy. It's basically a cost effort, so they have three copy editors in the newsroom. Those copy editors will look at major stories, investigative pieces, big pieces that go on the homepage, but just the general copy that goes out day and date on the website is not copy edited. And I think that it needs to be. I think there are some sort of grammatical errors that get in. I think there are factual errors that get in. I think there are big factual errors that get in. And I felt like that was a really easy mistake to catch. You know, if the first two people didn't catch it, the third person certainly would have, because it was a pretty obvious error.
If we could back up.
Sure.
Did you comment to the, you wrote a column on this.
I did write a column.
Did you comment to the Washington Post about NPR's actions before you'd written about it yourself?
No, they didn't call me to ask me.
And they did not.
No, they called the media relations person.
I see. They didn't get
right. That. So a lot of times, you know, the Washington Post has called me in the past for comment, or, you know, other news organizations. I actually don't see that as my role. I really don't talk to other news organizations. You know, I don't speak for NPR. I speak for myself. My column on the website is labeled opinion. So I figure NPR gives me a big enough platform to say what I want to say, so.
Well, yeah. let me ask about the role. Do you feel you've had the impact that you hoped to have when you started this work three years ago, is it?
I've been there 3 years. My contract's been extended for one more year. You know, it's hard to measure impact. The newsroom is very thoughtful. I guess I wouldn't say, oh, they made this change because of me. You'd have to ask them that. I'd like to think that I've raised issues that have then sort of been resolved in a way that I think is favorable. That's kind of a hard question to answer. When I first started, somebody asked me, someone inside the newsroom said, well, what are the metrics you're going to use to measure whether you were successful in your job? And that's not... You know, I spent a lot of time thinking about that, and I'm not quite sure what the metric is. In some ways, again, we're all on the same side. We all want the journalism to stay strong. you know, there have been changes that have taken place. They did hire one other copy editor after I wrote a column saying NPR needs to hire another copy editor. They did. But then I think then another copy editor left, so it was a wash. So.
So what's the most scathing criticism you've written of NPR?
What's the most scathing
or
criticism? Right. I don't, you know, in some ways it's all a blur. I write a column a week, and it's just, you know, we deal with probably 50 different issues a week. A lot of it doesn't get dealt with in the column. A lot of it is just dealt with internally. It's corrections. It's just talking about systemic problems that maybe don't rise to the issue of a column, but that really have to be dealt with. There have been a couple issues. You know, NPR had a problem a couple years ago. I felt that they weren't, so the public radio model obviously relies on a wide variety of funding. Some of it comes from the public, some of it comes from major donors, some of it comes from underwriters. A congressman raised a very valid critique, which was NPR had a major, one of NPR's major donors over many years was interviewed on the air, and there was no disclaimer or disclosure on that interview. This was the head of an NGO. The NGO had funded nuclear nonproliferation reporting at NPR for 10 years at about $100,000 a year. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, there was no influence in the reporting. But at one point, he had been interviewed on the air. And that's the kind of donor that you need to basically say, you know, we should just let you know that, you know, your organization is, you know, we should let the listeners know your organization is a funder of NPR. They didn't. This congressman sort of used that. He was making a broader point, which he thought that NPR's reporting was skewed against the Iran deal. No, skewed in favor of the Iran deal. And, you know, that's sort of one of those issues where we went back and we looked at 250 pieces that NPR had written about the Iran deal, and we found that it was really balanced, you know, in terms of the voices that were heard on the air. But when you lack disclosure for things like that, you know, it raises perception problems. So I wrote about that, and that is actually a change that NPR did make. I felt that they hadn't been transparent enough in their annual reports in saying who were the major donors and who were the corporate underwriters. They had just listed them for several years. They had listed them all together in one list. So they now break it out and say these are the groups that are funding the journalism as opposed to sort of buying a corporate underwriting spot. So that was actually a positive change. I'd forgotten about that.
So one more ombudsman question. I think, told me there's only four people with your job in the U.S.
Yes.
Today. You're kind of a dying breed.
It is a dying breed. yes.
And I think if I understood you, the reason, for instance, at the New York Times, why they did away with the public editor was to say that with social platforms, news organizations are being barraged with criticism. Much of it is very intelligent and thoughtful and accurate. So why do we need a public editor? What is the response to
that? What is the response? Right. So that was the Washington Post that basically said that, you know, Marty Baron has sort of been on the record as saying, you know, Twitter is the new public editor. You know, why do we need to pay someone in-house when we have Twitter? The New York Times got rid of their public editor last year. They did not actually say why they had gotten rid of the public editor. They just said they felt like the times had changed, but they didn't really actually comment about why. Again, the difference, so we get a lot of criticism on Twitter. My office operates a lot with a lot of criticism comes in over, people raise issues over Twitter. The difference is Twitter is a lot of noise. You know, you can get someone to say anything on Twitter. And I think the value, I mean, Twitter's very good if you do a mistake, if there's a mistake that someone makes on air on NPR, you know, Twitter is gonna tell you within 5 minutes or within 1 minute. And you can correct the error. That's you know, but an ombudsman's function is not really to deal with sort of day in, day out errors. It's to sort of look at sort of more systemic problems that listeners are raising. And, you know, Twitter, social media, that is, there's a lot of noise there. You can get a lot of competing claims. The value of an ombudsman is you can actually go and step back and say, no, this is a valid complaint. This one isn't. This one needs to be elevated. You have a platform in which to sort of elevate those complaints. And you have access. You're inside the organization. The organization has made a commitment that, you know, the NPR has basically said, we want our editors and our leadership to talk to the ombudsman when she comes calling. they don't like it always. It's unpleasant if you make a mistake. No one likes to be called on the carpet. But at the same time, there's a real sense of accountability inside the organization. So yeah, that's my argument.
I feel better, excuse me, when someone calls and is complaining about something that NPR has done.
Yes.
And when I can say, well, you can go to the ombudsman, I encourage you to do that. Uh-huh. Because and even that portal on the NPR page or contact a right. show, contact, you know, right. there's a person designated right. To listen to you. That seems to have value, especially for public media.
Right. I mean, I hope it builds trust. You know, we spend a lot of time talking about sort of the declining levels of trust in the media. So, I've tried to use my role to really bring, you know, the kind of transparency that would inspire more trust in the journalism.
So you tell us that the number one issue that people contact you about is bias.
Yes, political bias. Mm-hmm.
Tell us, and I think you wrote recently, bias is soaring in the past year.
It is, right? So since November.
Allegations of bias.
Allegations of bias. Thank you
bias
very much.
Itself.
Thank you very much. Right, so since November 2016, it's no surprise. People have felt much more politicized. So people are, I think, listening to the radio in a little bit of a different way. They're looking for different things. We've had quite a number of complaints. That's by far. We label all the complaints that come into the office. So political bias is the top one. We've started breaking it out by, you know, people who say that they feel the coverage is too liberal, and people who say the coverage is too conservative. It's pretty close to even now, from people who say that it's too conservative versus too liberal. People who, you know, are taking the time to express an opinion.
Is it more often they're making a claim of a pattern of bias, or they're saying that bias was evident in a particular?
Right, so that's tricky, right? So some people just make a blanket statement, and my response to that is, I haven't seen that pattern. If you have specifics that you want me to investigate, I'm happy to look into it. A lot of times it's, I think the format is sometimes challenging for listeners. So I don't know how many of you listen to All 2 Hours of Morning Edition or All 2 Hours of ATC, All Things Considered, every day. The average listener listens in the car on the way to work, and it's for a much shorter period of time. So, you know, you're not going to hear every story that's on the air. So if you hear an interview with a Republican congressperson on an issue one day, and you don't happen to catch the interview with the Democratic congressperson an hour later or the next day, and you hear that pattern 4 times in a row, then you're suddenly, you know, you're saying, hey, wait a minute, you're giving much more time to Republicans than you are to Democrats. So we spend a lot of time looking at those kinds of issues, sort of like tracking the voices that are heard on air. They actually balance out pretty well. It's amazing. I mean, it doesn't balance out every day. It doesn't even sometimes balance out every week. But if you look at it over time, I've been quite surprised at how well it balances out. So,
I think Karen's out there. I can't see a thing with these lights, but we have a microphone, and so we're We're going to include the audience in our conversation tonight. We're going to have a quiz later, but it won't be nearly as difficult as the one that was just administered. In fact, you can't even get the answers wrong.
Yes.
It's just opinions about ethics. But we will, you know, if you'd like to get involved in this conversation, you can indicate to the person with the microphone. But let me ask one more question about bias. I'm sure it'll come back up. But so from the network's perspective, I mean, the allegation of bias against NPR is longstanding and is constant. If one were to say, well, what do you do to make sure, you know, to keep an eye on that, would they say we have an ombudsman? Is that the bulwark against patterns of bias?
No, I think the newsroom itself works very hard to keep that out. So they work very hard to get multiple perspectives on multiple issues. I mean, it doesn't always work out absolutely perfectly because it's live radio. So, for example, Morning Edition has been moving to this model of many more live interviews in the morning. Well, so that means you have to find someone who will get up at 5 a.m. and talk on the radio live. Not everyone wants to do that, right? So that's a challenge. You have to find the right guest who is willing and able to be there in the right time slot. The guest has to agree to do it. You know, sometimes you'll have two Republicans in a row who are interviewed before you find a Democrat who actually has something valuable to say on the topic and who has availability. But the newsroom itself definitely is aware of those issues, and I think they work very hard to hear multiple perspectives. So. But certainly the ombudsman is, you know, we keep track of the numbers. You know, when we get complaints, we'll go in and I'm working on a column right now because we've had a lot of people who think that they're hearing too many of one voice and not enough of another. And so we're actually going in and tracking who is talking about the issues and what they're talking about.
The point that I've raised with the network is... or a starting point for the conversation is that the audience, I think, it's pretty unassailable. The Pew data shows the audience is a liberal audience. It tilts left. And the audience itself.
I've just observed a kind of
impatience with that comment in the discussion boards when I've raised it. It seems like
It's not quite that clear cut, actually. So Pew, I actually spent some time talking to Pew about this 2 weeks ago. So the last study they did about the NPR audience was in 2014. And the audience has changed completely since then, right? So there's been... It's a different listening environment. It's a different political environment. At that point, you're right, the audience definitely skewed liberal, but it was actually not, it was a pretty broad audience. It definitely was weighted liberal audience, but not overwhelmingly so by any means. But that data is, you know, 4 years old, and that's sort of, that's a long time in this political environment. So anecdotal evidence would say that there are a lot of conservatives who listen to NPR because they write me all the time. there are people who are actually really listening and not.
Sure.
Yeah.
Do we have someone out there?
Good evening and welcome.
Hello.
In the introduction, Karen mentions your knowledge of Sinclair Broadcasting.
Yes.
and it's been covered some on NPR this week. I have an ethical concern about Sinclair. First of all, as I'm sure you're well aware, they own 37% of the local media market, about to turn into 70 if they should acquire Tribune Broadcasting. They have launched this effort to have their anchors not ask them, demand that they make a written statement out against fake news, reading from a prepared script that they cannot change, telling them how to dress, not in red or white or blue, but something off color, a neutral shade. And I'm just wondering what your comments might be about the ethical behavior. I certainly have some concerns. This is the latest thing Sinclair has done. 2 years ago, as I'm sure you're aware, they launched something called the Terrorism Alert Network that they demanded, not asked, their stations air nightly. So I would just be concerned if your take.
Yeah, I will say, in my job at NPR, I actually don't comment on other media. I just feel like I have enough sort of enough on my plate with NPR. Yeah, I mean, there are, it's an interesting company. I spent a lot of time examining them many years ago and reporting on them, but I'm afraid I have to pass on that one. But see me after if you'd like to talk about.
Hi, so I am currently a student, and I've been writing quite a lot, and I also study philosophy, and so hearing about the work that you're doing, understanding in such a politically biased time with a lot of ethical and moral issues, I'm wondering if there are some solutions you suggest for people who are writing and reporting about emotionally disturbing ethical and moral issues without bias.
Uh-huh. That, it's an interesting issue. I think people spend a lot of time sort of thinking about, the role of journalism, I like to say, is to give citizens the information they need to make informed decisions, right? So you can decide how you feel about an issue. That's up to you. It's the journalist's role to give you enough information to make those decisions and come to an informed decision. If you're a journalist and you're wanting to do that in a highly politicized environment, you have to find a way for everyone to hear you. And so I think NPR does spend a lot of time sort of thinking about language issues, for example. So figuring out ways to talk about highly charged issues without adopting the language of one side or the other. Tax reform is a good issue that I like to highlight. So just framing it as reform is sort of immediately taking a side. Lots of people think there needed to be reform, lots of people didn't, thought there didn't. So there was a considered effort in the newsroom to say, okay, we're gonna talk about an overhaul of the tax system. So we're gonna find a language of common ground. So that's one way to do it, is to really sort of focus on the language, I think. Peter mentioned that political bias complaints are the number one that I hear. Second is language. People are really listening very, very closely to what they hear on the air and the words. And so I think the newsroom needs to, and I think for the most part does, make an effort to kind of adopt a language, without being wishy-washy, but just adopting a language that's very clear, but also language that everyone on whatever side you are on can hear. That's one way. I mean, I think transparency, goes a long way. There's a lot of talk in the journalism world about bringing much more transparency to what we do. There are folks who don't know the difference between opinion and analysis and straight reporting, so NPR has changed within the last year the way they label opinion columns. So it's just much clearer. So that's one thing that we're doing. I mean, just talking about how journalism works. I give a fair number of talks, and one of the issues that's come up in the past year that just astounds me, but because I've been in journalism for so long, is the number of people who don't realize who think that anonymous source is anonymous to the reporter. You laugh, except that's the language that we talk about anonymous sources. And so as journalists haven't necessarily spent enough time sort of explaining, an anonymous source means we know who the person is. We've double-checked the information to the best of our ability, but it's anonymous. This person has asked for confidentiality. So even just changing the language that we talk about, it's basic news literacy, right? So I think journalists are trying to do a lot more of that to foster trust in this kind of environment. And then the final thing I would point to is there's really a movement to kind of focus on facts. I got a really interesting letter the other day from someone who I agreed with. NPR had done a story about spending in Pennsylvania 18 in the campaign race there, and the outside Republican money far outweighed Democratic money. I think Republicans spent $10 million and the Democrats spent $2 million, if I have my facts right. The NPR reporter talked about how the Republicans had outspent, far outspent, and focused on the $10 million. They never said what the $2 million was. So the report wasn't wrong. The reporter, I think, just for time reasons, was categorizing it correctly. You know, the Democrats, the Republicans far outspent the Democrats. But listeners, I think, today really want to be able to make up their own minds, right? So I think to foster trust, you could have said Republicans spent $10 million, Democrats spent $2 million. And you give people the facts, and they can, you know, just as clearly make up their own minds without, you know, having to sort of resort to, well, are they telling the truth, or how are they shading it, or what are those numbers? So I think also sort of going back to the facts and putting that in, I think, helps.
And that's a good transition. Let's, if we could cue the slides and the audio. So the problem with misinformation,
yes,
has been exacerbated in the newsroom because there's a lot more interviews as opposed to scripted news,
yes,
reports.
Right.
There's a lot more live interviews.
A lot more live
going
interviews.
On, and
mm-hmm.
this is a challenging environment to, well, that's a challenging right. circumstance to be correcting and catching
right.
Misstatements or
right.
out-and-out lies.
Right.
So you've been writing about this. Talk a little bit about the conversation that is going on in the NPR newsroom about how to deal with this, and we have the audio we can listen to as well.
Sure. So this came up right after the transition in the election, so January, February 2017. As Peter said, NPR does a lot of live interviews, and things, if you'll recall, were a little bit heated at that time, and people are sort of, you know, battling it out on the radio, if you will. And there were quite a few live interviews where guests were coming on and they were making misstatements of fact. And they weren't being caught by the hosts. Now, the hosts have a really, really hard job. I'm not criticizing the hosts. I think they're pretty well prepared, but you can't know sort of every kind of obscure study that someone is going to throw at you. That's fine, but it's a real problem from my perspective because journalists aren't out there to spread misinformation. And so this kept happening over and over and over again. One of the things I was trying to get the newsroom to focus on is solutions for how to deal with this. So I think we have some audio that we're going to play that kind of will sort of illustrate one of the issues that came up.
Welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me back.
President Trump and other members of the administration have repeatedly said the courts have no ability to review this matter. Yesterday, Stephen Miller said, and I'm quoting here, the judiciary is not supreme. What does that mean?
Well, it means that we have separation of powers in the United States, and it seems as if certain judges deny that and think they have the ultimate authority when it comes to national security. So you don't have to read anything more into statements like that. And the fact is that the judiciary or specific judges are making gross mistakes. Just last year in 2016, a Senate subcommittee said there have been 72 people from the seven countries listed on that executive order who have been convicted of terrorist offenses in the United States in September the 11th. So when a judge or when anybody says these seven countries pose no threat to America, they're just flatly wrong, and that's the problem.
So if you don't recognize the voice, that's Sebastian Gorka. He was at the time a national security advisor to the president. He was heard quite a bit on NPR, so when NPR would go to the White House and say we need a guest to respond to or address certain issues, he was the person most often offered up. He had a series of very contentious interviews on NPR. So that statistic that he threw out there, that was a live interview, and it was wrong. And, you know, that's a problem, right? So there are, what, 4 million people at any given time in a morning hearing a live interview on NPR? Maybe a little less, but that's a lot of people to hear a mistake. So here's one way, we'll listen to one way that NPR handled it later that morning.
Let's take a moment to examine that claim. Mr. Gorka is referring here to a report from the Center for Immigration Studies, which is a group that advocates for less immigration to the U.S. The Washington Post has fact-checked this report, and they found that while some of the 72 people on the list were convicted of providing material support to terrorists, it also included people who were convicted of passport or visa fraud, not terrorism-related offenses. They found that it earned a, quote, 3 Pinocchios rating out of a possible 4, which means the Post found there to be significant factual errors in that claim. So now let's get back to the rest of that conversation with Sebastian Gorka. And I asked him about President Trump's specific attacks on judges.
One way NPR handled it, and I thought it was pretty good. So NPR interviews, excuse me, they get rerun across the morning. So if you're real groupies, then you'll hear it at 5 a.m. and you'll hear it again at 7 a.m. But also it gets repeated across time zones. So what they had to do was an editor caught that mistake after it had been on the air live. They actually went back into the live interview, which they rarely do, and it's complicated and it's time sensitive, and but they felt like it was egregious enough that they wanted to correct it right then and there. And he actually, in the course of his first live interview, made a second error. So they actually broke into that piece for the repeat and corrected it twice. My point in the column that we had posted was, that's great. That's fine for sort of the people who heard the rebroadcast of that interview. That didn't do anything for the 4 million people who heard the original error. And that's a problem. So NPR, another thing I've been very critical of NPR about is that they rarely, they put an editor's note on the transcript when it ran on the NPR.org, but they didn't make a correction on air. So they didn't come back the next day and say, you know, Sebastian Gorka misspoke, or he deliberately fudged the numbers, or, you know, whatever interpretation you want. So it was in the transcript, but it wasn't on air. So there's still 4 million people out there who heard misinformation, and that's not what NPR is in the business to do. So I think that's been a challenge. I think it remains a challenge in the newsroom. One solution they have come up with that I think has worked pretty well, is that they have now, for some interviews that they're doing live, they're reserving 10 seconds, 15 seconds, 45 seconds at the end. They'll have a beat reporter listening in on the interview, and then they will go to the beat reporter and they'll say, okay, what did you hear? Was there any misstatement of fact there, or what is the context, or give us a broader context? But that, I think, has worked pretty well. I do think NPR still is challenged a little bit.
Seems like the other solution would just be to do less live interviewing and have more reporters reporting.
And there are people who are arguing very strongly that NPR needs to do fewer of these live interviews because of that. You know, it's also a judgment call, right? So if the other day there was someone who was a guest on air who was a talker. and so this person, I heard, I heard an error go by, but it was, it was a minute and 30 seconds later before this person stopped talking, where the host had a chance to sort of break in. And what are you gonna do at that point? If you're the host and you're doing live radio, are you gonna go back and say, okay, well, 90 seconds ago, I heard you say X. That doesn't make for a satisfying conversation. But again, there is misinformation that got on the air. So I think that is something that NPR still hasn't quite, from my perspective, fully grappled with, and I think they need to find a more satisfying solution.
Hi, I just want to start by saying I do listen to NPR. I love NPR.
Right.
I do. I'm also one of those dinosaurs. I know a dying breed that actually subscribes to newspapers and has it delivered to my door and actually reads a hard copy.
That's great.
And I read not only liberal op-eds, but conservative op-eds. So I really try, I think, to get real news and a balanced opinion. There really is such a thing as fake news, but I don't think it is the legitimate journalist media. Uh-huh. So my question is, what do we do? I don't do Twitter, I don't do Facebook. I don't trust those sources for my news. What do we do to keep our free press, to keep our First Amendment constitutional right to a free press and a media, an actual source of legitimate journalistic news sources? Mm-hmm. Because I think that that source is not going to be there very long if we can't support it financially. How do we keep that? Mm-hmm. I mean, how
give
do we...
Give to public radio.
Yeah, I was going to say, give to public radio.
There must be more.
Subscribe to your newspapers. No, I think that is, you know, that is the challenge of our era, right? The financial model for journalism is changing. I have said many times, I am very lucky. I am, you know, a lot of my colleagues who I went into journalism, we went into journalism at the same time, they're not working in journalism anymore because they've been downsized and, you know, lost jobs. And when I was at the LA Times, the newsroom was, I think, about 1,200 people, and now I think it's under 500. So, it is the challenge of our era. I the best I can say at this point is sort of support trustworthy, newsworthy, trustworthy news newsrooms. There are a lot of people who are sort of working on this issue. A lot of foundations are out there really trying to find a workable model. I think collaboration is, we were talking about that a little this afternoon. I think, there's a lot of collaboration going on between newsrooms these days, and I think that is one model that probably will emerge to help the financial basis of the business, sort of working all together, sort of, one piece of journalism shared over many different outlets. So I think you'll see a lot more of that.
Hi, my name is Ryan. I'm one of the listeners in the morning of Morning Edition driving around. And I've noticed the, both sides, conservative and liberal, maybe senators or politicians in the mornings. But sometimes and maybe it's the wake up at 5 a.m. thing, but it seems that it's the conservative guests that they have sometimes are so far conservative that I sometimes think often it doesn't give a good conversation or reporting for some more intelligent, real conversations or to be reported. It's almost like too far to where in my head I just discount it and not even want to listen or laugh or get upset and turn it off. So
I do think one of the challenges, I think there are two parts to that question. So one is there are a lot of guests, and I think guests from both sides, who are coming on with talking points, who are there kind of not to have a conversation necessarily, but to, they've got their talking points and they're going to stick to them. I will say the newsroom does work hard to find guests who are more willing to engage in the issues. It doesn't always work out that way. There were a couple interviews recently where, I think the newsroom was disappointed because they had thought the guest was going to come on and sort of have a conversation, and it wasn't so much that way. But I think the other issue is we live in this era where there's so... We often try to think of things as sort of left versus right. But, the last election taught us the left is not the left. You know, the left is Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, right? So the right is Republicans who support Trump and Republicans who don't support the president. I mean, it's just there's a real multiplicity of views out there these days. And I think the newsroom has really sort of works hard at, but would probably acknowledge that they sometimes need to work harder at getting that wide range. But again, that becomes then, it becomes a challenge for the listener, because you, if you're not hearing your own point of view reflected, because there are multiple points of view out there, then you get worried that sort of the news is being skewed, if you will. So I think the newsroom does try to get a wide range, but I think it's a challenge.
All right, let's move on to our quiz. For this, I want to invite Nate Payne up. Speaking of other sources of excellent journalism, Nate is the editor of the Traverse City Record Eagle. He's going to join our panel. Welcome, Nate. Just a little anecdote. I was pleased to discover we sent Morgan Springer down to the investigative reporters and editors training last week, and Kyle Kaminsky from the Record Eagle was there, and the Record Eagle has sent other reporters and, in fact, had the IRE team come up and train their newsroom. So, speaking to the question here about sustaining trustworthy journalism for a town this size, there's a lot of it going on, and the entities you see up here are working hard to further that and develop it. So, welcome, Nate. We're glad
Thanks for
you
having
join
me.
Us. Yeah. So this is our format here. This is kind of, we're going to have to crane our necks. But so this is what I saw when I met Elizabeth. Her and her colleagues from NPR had a presentation like this that I thought was interesting. So we'll have audience participation. Everyone can take a look at this, and we can discuss it. And then we'll raise our hand about which way we tilt.
You want to read it?
Well, you can go ahead.
Congress is considering changes to the healthcare law, which critics say could make it harder for women to access contraception. A reporter has a sister who once went to Planned Parenthood for an abortion. The sister writes a well-reasoned argument about why the plan is a bad idea. The reporter wants to share it on his Facebook page, should he? So how many of you think, yes, the reporter is not endorsing that viewpoint? No one? Few hands, okay. No, by sharing his sister's view, the reporter is giving his audience a reason to think that he cannot report on the topic objectively. How many of you?
So this one is interesting. Because this was, I remember this in St. Paul, and
yes.
I thought, oh, it's clearly no.
It's clearly no. Mm-hmm.
But somebody on the panel pointed out that if a listener later made this connection, and then would be in a position to accuse the reporter in the newsroom of hiding this fact.
Right.
And so maybe it's better to get it out in the open for people to see and decide what they think about it. And that really gave me pause, then it didn't seem so simple after that.
So we were talking earlier, journalists who deal with ethical issues reside in the gray spaces, right? It's never sort of black and white. And there's sort of often an argument to be made on either side. Newsrooms all over are grappling with these kinds of issues with social media, how much to be transparent, how much to allow people to sort of express their own point of view. What's your newsroom's policy?
We have a pretty strict social media policy, just to try to mitigate that, to give some guidelines and rules. But we've even talked on the much more ethereal end of things. Reporters are encouraged to share news stories that they find interesting, whether they're produced by their news organization or someone else's. Well, if you look at that body of sharing, can you pinpoint or could a reader potentially start to accuse a reporter of some sort of bias or leaning because of a year's worth of posts?
Right. Right. No, this is one of the thorniest issues that people are, perception is reality in many cases, or at least it can have the unintended effect of causing people to doubt your journalism. So I think it was Mark Memmott, NPR standards editor, who said, well, you know, maybe the reporter does share it and says, this is not a point of view, you know, necessarily that I endorse, but I found this an interesting argument. Therefore, you've been transparent. You know where the reporter's coming from. You know, and sometimes you have to say, you know, I'm sharing this, but, you know, my reporting, you know, I make every effort in my reporting to get both sides of the view or, you know, of the on the issue.
And this was a real situation in the NPR newsroom?
This was a real situation in a station newsroom, I believe, not an NPR newsroom.
Do you know what the outcome was?
I do not know. I do not know.
So in, your policy would not allow this? It would be a clear no?
Generally not, but that falls in a strange gray area. It's not authored by the reporter. It's the sort of an endorsement of a viewpoint, but it's a family member. I could see falling on a really awful ethical conversation that would last hours.
What about defending journalism on social media? A reporter defending, for instance, if the President of the United States would say disparaging things about the news media, and someone on his or her Facebook page would say that's not true about me or my colleagues.
Right. That is a very real world issue that journalists have been confronting for the past year or so. NPR's former head of news, who's no longer at the network, but he was very clear that we are not in a war. Someone can be, you know, in a war with us, but we are not in a war. We're not a party to that war. I tend to endorse that view. You know, our job is to do the work. We are journalists, we do the work. It's not to sort of get into a war with anyone. If they want to have a war with us, that's fine. But that is the one sort of area where, you know, for the most part, people in the NPR newsroom are not allowed to give to political causes. They're not allowed to express political points of view. They're not allowed to march. They can give money to nonprofits such as the Committee to Protect Journalists. That is sort of the one exception. So,
any thoughts out there on social media use? Looks like maybe we do.
My question was something else, but...
Well, just hold then. We'll get through a couple of these, and you'll be next.
But on the social media, I just want to say that I don't tune into NPR to hear an equally balanced number of left versus right wing nuts. I tune in, as Mr. Payette suggested, for reporting, for honest, straightforward reporting. Mm-hmm. And bias has been turned into an evil term when in fact it's often means you know something about what you're talking about. So how do you cope with that?
Okay, I'll read this one.
Okay.
Now it's getting exciting. The President of the United States reportedly used vulgar language during a closed-door meeting. Should NPR air the phrase that he used? A, no, it's offensive to many listeners, and reporters can convey the meaning without using the actual word. B, yes, but bleep it. C, yes, it's important to tell the story accurately. Use it in its entirety and issue a language advisory at the beginning of the story.
Okay, real quick, who's for A? B? C? Wow.
That's pretty clear.
Okay. So this was actually really one of the more interesting columns that I've worked on, I think, recently. NPR sort of did both. So if you were close listeners, this news broke sort of mid-afternoon on a Thursday. NPR made the decision that evening not to use the word. They were calling it a vulgar... I can't remember now. Anyway, they're vulgar obscenity, something like that. Then overnight at about 7 a.m., they changed their mind and they just started using it. Much to the surprise of many, many listeners. So I started getting reaction from listeners on Thursday night, and they were upset. They thought that NPR was being too timid by not using the word, that they were sort of giving a pass to the president, that the president had used very strong language, that they needed to, that NPR should be using the word, and that NPR was not using it out of timidity or not wanting to offend the administration. Then, of course, the next day when NPR did start using it, I got all those criticisms too. And there were a few complaints. You can see CBS posted them the other day. There were, I think, 10 to 15 complaints to the FCC about NPR stations that did air that, did air the word. The FCC did not say how they're going to rule on that. I think NPR, the feeling of NPR is they have a pretty strong legal reason for being able to use the word, and there is a there is a newsworthy exception for allowing the word. What I found interesting about this, so I wanted to write about this, like why was NPR being, were they actually being timid? And so I went to the deputy managing editor on duty that night who had made that decision, and he's a very thoughtful man, and he said, the reason, it had nothing to do with timidity, it had nothing to do with the FCC. The reason I did not use that word was because I knew the second we used the word, the debate would become over the word. And he said that what was really interesting to me, what I thought was much more newsworthy, was the implication of that, right? So that it was, it was the question about how the president's, in making those remarks, how he views the world, how he views African nations versus how he views Scandinavian nations, how he views, African-American countries versus, or African black countries versus white countries, essentially. And he said, I was afraid that if we used the word, we would get focused on the obscenity. And so I thought that was really interesting. I mean, I thought that was a very thoughtful response. So I'm, he's basically saying, I was focused on the news value of the story. I still think he should have used the word that night. I'm glad NPR did ultimately use the word. I think that's what we're in the business of doing. We tell the story, we tell the story clearly. I think in this case, there was value in hearing the word. But I just, people can jump to conclusions about why newsrooms are making decisions, and that may not, be the case. So, use the word?
Yes. We published it, and it wasn't a long debate, but it was similar. It was, you're talking about our top elected official and the language that they're using. It seemed pretty pertinent at that point and newsworthy.
Right.
Don't you usually sort of do the print equivalent of a bleep with some dashes?
Yeah, some dashes.
Did you do that in this case?
No.
How do you decide when that's appropriate and when it's not?
It's case by case. I know we've, in this case, it seemed meaningful that, who was saying it mattered. If it was an off-the-cuff comment in a cop's brief, maybe it's not really, noteworthy. I think we did something similar. I published a quote by Jeffrey Feiger last year sometime. There was a direct quote about accusations against him. And we debated about whether to bleep or not. And I actually got more blowback about publishing that full word without dashes than I did in this case.
And Feiger's prominence was part of the calculation there, that he's well-known
and it was a
kind of crazy guy.
He was refuting some accusations against him, and it was very strong language.
All right. Nate, this one's from your shop. I'll let you read it.
All right. An alleged victim of a violent crime calls a reporter to ask him not to report on charges levied against a family member accused of felonious assault. Should he continue to pursue the story? Yes, a prosecutor has decided to pursue criminal charges, and in doing so, move the accusations into public court records, or no. It's important to respect a victim's plea for privacy.
So who would think yes is the answer to that question? Who thinks no? Did everybody's hand go up? Maybe we have to talk about this first, and then we'll ask. It seems like a hands-down yes to me. If the prosecutor's office is going ahead with charges and the paper typically covers that type of crime, I don't... I'm having trouble. I'm sympathetic.
That's generally where we err, but we get this request probably on a weekly basis, depending on what it is. And, you know, there are situations that are... They're more difficult, because you don't know... If there's not a cooperative victim, it's difficult for the prosecutor to pursue charges and actually pursue a case.
But in this case, it was public already, right? It was going to become public?
And, yeah, this right. was... They had right. filed the charges, and the victim basically... Mm-hmm. It was a strange situation. It came into a... It really raised the trust issue, because the reporter called the accused for comment. He declined comment, and then 15 minutes later, the alleged victim called unprompted to say, please don't write about this.
And you did write about it?
Yes.
Yes.
Has there been a case where a call like this has been persuasive?
Not in my recollection. For the most part, if it's a big enough issue for us to be writing about, it's noteworthy. And we'll move forward with it. Maybe we would note that protest in print if the person was willing.
What people who were undecided out there, what would you like to know, or what makes you reticent to say yes or no, Jack?
I'll try to complicate the question a little bit more. It seems to me that you do withhold names, for instance, your sources, for one, and you withhold names of people who give you information and say, but they insist upon anonymity for doing that. But you won't do it in this case, where the victim has actually asked for the name to be withheld. There's a bigger issue that I'll throw at you, though, and that is in Europe, they don't identify the names of perpetrators of crimes. They say George B. or William S., because they don't want to glorify the perpetrators. They want to hide their identity as much as possible. Even, you may say, well, it's in the public court record, but who reads the public court record? You know, just the reporters, right? So, you know, why do the, in this case, or why help these criminals who are looking for glory in some cases? Why not submerge their identity? Or use an expletive, if you will, for them instead.
Do you want to?
I think at least on our level, the vast majority of people we write about who are caught up in the court system are not seeking glory, and they and I've had threats to prove it. But you know, our persistent position would be that you. One, you deserve to understand what's happening in your court system on your behalf. You paid for it. And there is a significant public interest in what people are doing in your community, what either accused of or you know, being investigated for. Those are certainly newsworthy.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the issue of sort of whether or not to name a perpetrator of a mass shooting, for example, is one that a lot of newsrooms are grappling with right now. It's a little bit different than sort of court records. The NPR newsroom has sort of come to sort of a hybrid approach. So the feeling is that it's important to know who is perpetrating a crime. If you don't know who it is, there are conspiracy theories that grow up, et cetera. I mean, you need to know. I mean, this is the feeling in the newsroom is that there is a public need to know who the person is. Then at that point, the newsroom has been instructed to minimize use of the actual name. Because there is some social science out there that says that some perpetrators of crimes like this are in it for the glory. You know, there's been a few stories about the Parkland shooter and people who are, you know, writing to him in jail now, and he's got a certain amount of celebrity. So the newsroom at that point has sort of been instructed to back off, to talk about the shooter, but not to use the shooter's name. So it's a little bit of a hybrid approach. I don't know. You know, I think that's still an ongoing debate over how to handle these kinds of situations. Again, it's one of those thorny issues that I don't know that there's a right or wrong, and I think newsrooms are grappling with it right now.
Let's jump ahead. We'll do one more, and then we can have a few more general questions. I'm going to skip. So this is from IPR, and it's a little more involved. So this is a series that Morgan Springer has done called Irredeemable. Thank you. And these are stories about people who have been sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. The U.S. Supreme Court has said that's because it was a mandatory sentence, it's not a constitutional punishment, and they need to have their cases reconsidered. They need to be resentenced. And when we got into this, the fellow up there is Jay Fusan, who is a poet in a correctional facility down in southeast Michigan. And so when we started talking about the series and branding it, we started talking about an image to go with it. And this is what we actually used and what you would find on our website. And it's on cards out in the lobby. But initially, we said, well, maybe we could get some artwork through the Michigan prison, this art program in the Michigan prison system. And so we purchased this piece by David Jones, who is also a juvenile lifer. And we were ready to run with this. We started working with someone in the marketing department at Interlochen, and she said to us that that image with the word irredeemable would perpetuate the stereotype of black men being criminals. And we did not talk about this for very long. We said, we think you're right, and we actually paid a kill fee to the artist, which I'm not sure was the right, I think we needed to pay him. We might have just paid him the full amount, but that was what we did. But what was interesting was he came back in an email with his view about this. And he goes on in the next slide, but I'll give everyone a minute just to digest that. So I guess the question here would be, did we make the right decision or the wrong one with that piece of artwork with the title of a radio reporting series called Irredeemable be problematic or not? So who thinks that we made the right decision? Who thinks we made the wrong decision?
Interesting.
What's that?
It just needs a new title.
Titles are notoriously hard for series. We talked about the question mark. The term irredeemable, it was our spin on the legal term, which is irreparably corrupt. That is the legal standard that's used in court. So we thought irredeemable was basically that, and so we did discuss that issue, but we felt secure there. What do you two think?
I think images are challenging, right? Because you're asking for one image to stand in for an entire series, or I think the newsroom at NPR, we do run quite a few images on the website. We spend a lot of time. The journalists there spend a lot of time thinking about that. Photography, I think, is hard. You know, a photographer is there to document an image, right? So you don't want to skew it. We had one issue at the NPR newsroom where they were shooting outside a methadone clinic. The person who happened to walk by was black. That was the image that got used. I mean, you can't manipulate the image, you can't, but we got a complaint about that, perpetuating a stereotype. One complaint that I did did resonate with me was there was an image used in a story about the opioid epidemic, and the person in the photo was black. The opioid epidemic is largely, it's overwhelmingly white. and that was, you know, again, that was the image they had, but I actually think they should have looked harder to find something that was more representative. So I think these are challenging issues.
Do you have any thoughts on this?
I mean, that seems like a pretty reasonable argument that your coverage should be relatively reflective of reality or the numbers or whatever.
Right.
And I can see that argument for using this image. But by the way, I love the series.
Thanks.
It's amazing. It's really well done.
So let's spend our final few minutes. We'll just take the microphone around and let's try and be brief in our answers and see if
sure.
we can get... The staff? Okay, how about we do that at the very end? Thank you.
So I've been listening to public radio since the 70s, so it's over 40 years. But lately I've been noticing an annoying and upsetting trend. One of the hosts on Morning Edition is kind of getting into mansplaining. Steve Inskeep, and unfortunately starting to contaminate the other hosts. And so I just wonder if there's any, if that's a policy change where he will, like, in January of 2017, he explained what a distribution center was. I'm like, first of all, that's not important. Secondly, you're interrupting the flow of this interview with someone, you're taking up time, and then at the end, you have to cut off the person that you're interviewing, which sort of ties into your what you raised about the live interviews.
Right.
I mean, maybe we could solve two problems if the interviews were taped and edited, but I mean, I feel like you're dumbing down.
That's interesting. I don't know that. I don't know of any policy that exists.
Well, please tell them to stop.
Okay. I will take the feedback back.
Hi. Thank you for the presentation tonight. I think of movie ratings. And it would take somebody smarter than me to do this, but I think about on Facebook, can we not, and even with television, other media, can we not have a Facebook set up a fact check group? And I know there are thousands of things that come in each day, but any person submitting anything on Facebook can have the choice of submitting it to a fact check group or not first, some kind of scrutiny. If they don't, fine, but every Facebook post will say, this is the 300th post of this person, zero have been submitted to us for fact check.
Mm-hmm.
This goes to your point about the person, the report earlier where you said the reporter should just give the facts and let people decide for themselves. So it seems to me there's mechanisms that could be set in place. And on TV shows that purport to be news shows, just how many live opposing views mm-hmm. any particular TV show presents. I know it's complicated, but are we not at a stage where we need to have some kind of little bit of a tweak there, you know, movie rating system.
Yeah, I can tell you a little bit about what some in the journalism world are doing. Actually, there's been a lot of sort of talk about this.
Yeah. Thank you.
There's a group out of Santa Clara University. It's called the News Trust Project. Are you familiar with them? And they are working on, it's almost like the good housekeeping seal of approval. So journalistic organizations that subscribe to a certain number of elements that make for trustworthy journalism. So things like you have a corrections policy, your corrections are posted prominently, you do correct your material quickly, you have accountability so that if you you know, that, so that you have an ombudsman or a public editor, or your editor in chief is there to take phone calls. Anyway, news organizations that sort of can work to get this trustworthy check mark, and that button is supposed to sort of be put on stories that go on Facebook. To say this comes from a trustworthy news organization. There are probably half a dozen different projects like that. The Trust Project is one of the biggest, but yeah, the people are working on that, so at least from the news point of view. So.
Where's the microphone?
Oops. On March 13th, I heard on WIAA a very proud declamation that they weren't going to play any more recordings by James Levine. Presumably, hashtag Me Too inspired. I'm on three of those recordings, and it kind of broke my heart. Mm. How far do you go casting the net of the unlistenable to? Shall we throw out Wagner? Shall we throw out everybody who's ever made a mistake? And particularly surrounding the 70s and 80s, I wonder how many women in here were not somehow at least demeaned or put down or made uncomfortable by a man. I bet everyone would say yes. And I know there are degrees on things, but how do you draw that line to stop broadcasting people because somebody involved with a project sinned?
Well, I'm caught a little off guard here because my music hosts are not here, and I wasn't involved in those discussions, so I can't give a satisfactory answer. But if I could find you later, I'd like to talk more about that and have some exchange. I don't know how that her comments translate to the to news.
I don't not so much with news. I mean, I think a lot of the arts world is grappling with that sort of, you know, how far back do you go? There are, you know, movie directors, you know, who go way back who were notorious, and you know, do you stop showing their movies? I don't know. I think it's a, I think it's an ongoing debate.
Hi, I'm Jessie. I'm a student from Front Street Writers in the afternoon session. I just wanted to say thank you for coming to our classroom, even though I didn't get the chance to see you this morning. But my particular angle on the gun violence story is what Jack was talking about, over whether we should name the shooter or how far we should go in covering these events.
Right.
And I was just wondering what tips you have or what suggestions you have so we avoid being gratuitous or just overly detailed, but still informing the public.
Thoughts? You must have covered these.
That's always a difficult balance. How much do you describe to describe something that's horrific adequately to convey that versus going too far and really giving somebody something, giving the perpetrator something that they wanted? Mm-hmm. You know, we've debated naming or not naming several times over, and I think that debate will continue.
Yeah, yeah, we had some varied, well, I think it wasn't just the Irredeemable series, but a woman who was just a little overwhelmed with the violence being described in the news. Mm-hmm. And she, in her message, she even kind of associated it, I think, with her loneliness, and the combination of living alone and then hearing all this on the radio, I think really, really kind of mm-hmm. harmed her psychically. And she told us that.
Right. I think NPR has been erring on the side of many more warnings to listeners these days, basically saying, you know, you may find this content disturbing. You might want to turn off your radio for a couple minutes if you do. I think NPR probably has also been, I haven't heard things which I think are gratuitous, but I think they've been pretty clear in their reporting about what happened, so.
I think we're at the end of our time. So let me introduce the news staff at Interlochen Public Radio. They can just stand in their seats. David Castleman is there. Morgan Springer. Dan Juan Shura, I think, is in this building. He's back in the corner. By the door. and Aaron Selvig was running around with a camera. There he is. So thanks to Karen and Jack Siegel for running the International Affairs Forum and being so easy to work with for this event. Thank you all for coming. Nate, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Elizabeth, it has been a pleasure having you here.
Thank you. My pleasure. I enjoyed it. Thank you.